This episode of Addiction, an Hour with Hour, is brought to you by Gaming Laboratories International. GLI is a world-class testing, inspections, and certification company committed to delivering the highest quality land-based, lottery, and iGaming testing and assessment services around the world. GLI provides suppliers, operators, and regulators with expert guidance for navigating the future of gaming and ensuring gaming innovations meet regulatory standards with confidence in more than 710 jurisdictions. For more information, visit GamingLabs.com. Hello and welcome to Addiction, an Hour with Hour, the podcast that might today be renamed as Addiction 45 Minutes with an Hour, thanks to some technical issues, some of which were my fault. I am John Bruford, the minor of your hosts, joined by your major, Dr. Michael Hour. Dr. Hour, hello.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm doing okay, how are you?
Even better.
It doesn't surprise me. It's not a competition. This is not a game of top trumps. Do they have top trumps in Austria?
Absolutely, yeah. No, I'm just, you know, trying to spread positivity, you know.
Austrian style.
And yeah, I have my, on the opposite wall here, I have affirmations written, you know. Affirmations, you know, you are best, you are the greatest, you are awesome, you are strong, you are pretty.
Are those the actual affirmations?
I read them, like, you know, regularly, just, you know, to get myself going. Yeah. I mean, that's psychologically proven, it works.
My significant other, she gave me a wonderful phrase. I apologize if I brought this up before on this podcast, but it was really, it struck a real chord with me. And she was talking to me about a process she had undertaken herself. And she said, I taught myself the phrase, I give myself permission to be happy.
Absolutely. But on the other hand, she's only known you for a couple of months.
Yeah, there is still time. We're actually at the 6 month mark, just so you know.
Oh my God. OMG.
That's what she says. And I don't even mean that the way that that just sounded. Sorry. If Maris is listening, that was not that's what she said. that was entirely unintentional.
A relationship of 6 months, did you say that?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, God. You know how long I'm married with the same woman?
5 months.
Yeah. 51 years.
Okay, let me quickly think. That's my age. Oh, spoiler alert. No,
I
was wrong 10 years.
We got married in October 76. How? 74.
74. Yeah, 74, which day? 76. Which day? Which day? Which day?
The 25th of October.
Oh, I was born October 29. 74.
Just in time for you to be born in wedlock, you have been Peter's son.
pretty immature.
74, 74. Casino News in the Netherlands, you probably have heard of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I did an interview with them. If you go and have a look on their website, and if you look at interviews, and if you scroll down to mine, you can even see a photo when we got married in 20, because I gave them a lot of very old stuff as well.
Nice.
Wow. I'm a big fan of Casino News.
How old are
News.
You, Peter?
I love Frank.
How old I am? I am at this very moment, I'm 76 years old.
All right.
In September, I'm going to be 77. So 77, I thought, oh, maybe I should celebrate it. No, but I have my birthday the week before we have the conference in Copenhagen.
So I'm a huge fan of Casino News, and I just want to big up Frank and the work that he's done there, because they've done some really lovely stuff. Casino, that's Casino News, but News is spelt the Dutch way, isn't it? Is N I E U W S?
N I E U W S. Yeah, News.
But terrific site, great people. Frank is an absolute legend. Yeah. Also, he loves his movies. We had a lovely conversation last time I saw him about the merits of Paul Verhoeven. Okay. Anyway, I haven't even introduced you yet, Peter.
No.
And I blame Michael for that. We're joined today by Peter Remmers, a veteran RG legend of the space. If you're not familiar with Peter, then where have you been? But let's say, for example, I'm not familiar with Peter. Peter, what's your background? Apart from being married to the same woman for 51 years, which is the same amount of time as I've been alive. I'm 52 this summer.
Very good.
I'm older than Michael. My God, how has he got hair and I haven't? Anyway, so you both got the hair.
Guys, it's not about the age. It's about the things that you like to do in life, which and then you get older by itself, to be honest. When I was studying at the Free University in Amsterdam, economics, at the end of the day, I thought, but this is absolutely not what I want. So as a 23-year-old, I started to work in a home where young boys between 12 and 21 used to live and stay, who couldn't stay at home because their parents, I always said, that their parents were not able to bring them up in a proper way, so to say. So they couldn't stay at home. They had to be educated in another place. After a couple of years, I said to my boss in those days, I think I'm going to look for another job. And by coincidence, I got involved in the outpatient treatment clinic that Jerinek was running. Jerinek is the largest treatment agency in the Netherlands, had a lot of outpatient and inpatient treatment facilities, prevention departments, etc., etc. So I started to work there in the early 80s. And I think it was 1988 when my boss came to me and said, I want you to do this project for me. Because he was doing an MBA program at the university summer in the Netherlands, and in his class was also the CEO of Holland Casino, the guy who was the CEO of Holland Casino in those days. So, and then they agreed on that we should do a... Are you going to get the dog? That we should do a project together where we, as Jerinek, could explain what is problem gambling, what does the problem look like, and what should you do about it. So that's how it started. I had never been in a casino before 1988, and after that I've been to so many casinos that, I've never been in Japan, so... that's one of the few places I've never been in a casino. Well, there are no casinos in Japan anyway.
Yeah, not yet, I think.
Yeah.
So, and back then, you mentioned 88, was gambling actually mentioned in any of the diagnostic instruments like DSM or ICD?
Yeah, well, honestly, yeah, in those days, in fact, gambling problems were coming up, so to say. So we were confronted with people that came to our outpatient treatment facility saying, I have a gambling problem. But the ministry who was financing, the Ministry of Social Welfare, etc., treatment facilities did not allow us to treat people with gambling problems. But there was another good thing going on, because most of the guys that were having a gambling problem were drinking too much as well. Mm-hmm. So we just classified them as an alcoholic. And in the meantime, there was this possibility of treating people with gambling problems. Working together with the industry, Holland Casino, which was, I think, in fact, the first operator in the whole world that paid really attention to the topic. Of course, you had Harrah's in the U.S. that always claimed we were the very first, and they had a project called Project 21, which meant they didn't allow minors into their casinos, and that was their responsible gambling program, so to say. So what we did in those early days is that all the employees of Holland Casino got a what we would now call a kind of awareness training program. We were to explain what problem gambling was, and in fact we did in 4 months we did 114 sessions related to the issue. So we were allowed to explain what it was about, but not necessarily the Holland Casino employees were allowed to do something further on in a way of identifying problems and doing something more. That came later, to be honest. So it was kind of part of the process. We were doing that, and in fact, there were not a lot of people in the whole world that were paying attention to problem gambling. In fact, I always say there were four of us in those early days. One of them, and Michael knows him as well, was Thomas Nielsen. Thomas Nielsen was running a project in Sweden together with a colleague, and that was focusing on treatment and prevention projects. The other guy that was in our small group was Paul Bellringer. Paul Bellringer was what we would now call the CEO of ChemCare. I know Paul from even before ChemCare became ChemCare, so to say. And there was another guy from Sydney, Australia, Paul Simon, who was what we would now call a guy with lived experience, so to say. He was a former gambler, lost all his money and started to earn it back, so to say, by delivering training and telephone counseling services to operators in Australia. So the four of us were, in fact, I mean, I don't say we were the only four in the whole world, but it's getting, I think we are rather close to say there were not a lot of other people. And now, if you look at it at this moment, everyone, every itself respected operator has a responsible gambling manager or whatever you would like to call them. And sometimes mandatory because the regulators would like you to do so, and sometimes because they do this still on a voluntary level. But that's how it started, 88. And the good thing for me was because when they decided that that gambling we should pay more attention to gambling, I started to run what was called Jelinek Consultancy, and in Jelinek Consultancy we did all these projects for which the other party had to pay, so to say, because we didn't do those things for free. In fact, Holland Casino had to pay for all these training sessions, which they did rather easily, to be honest, not very difficult.
But these training sessions that you're mentioning were for staff, right? Holland Casino employees.
All employees of Holland Casinos had to do these training sessions on a mandatory basis. Mm. Yeah. So in fact, what we try to do is to explain what is problem gambling, what does it look like, what are the symptoms, and what within the policy of Holland Casino could be done and should be done, so to say. So in the beginning, there were a few people who were appointed by their local casino manager to pay some attention to that. But honestly, we still are running the training programs for Holland Casino after all these years, so which is 37 years now, I think, something like that. And of course, the content has changed a lot. I mean, from trying to explain what the issue looks like, we are working now more and more on how to communicate with the employees and the guests related to the issue.
And about the communication, like, so, you know, employee to guest, what are like crucial aspects, like basic guidelines? that you recommend that, you know, are sort of have proven to be effective?
Well, that's honestly, I always say that's a difficult one. Have proven to be effective because, because I think that's part of the difficulty we still have is how effective are our prevention policies, so to say. And what we try to do is set up standards and say, okay, if we just follow these standards, then you have a number of signals that we could identify as causing possibly harm to the individual, so to say. And in fact, maybe it's the markers of harm situation avant la lettre, so to say, because what we try to do is that we use the employees in the casinos a lot by asking themselves, what is your top five, what is your top three related to issues that you think are involved in when we talk about developing problems by the individuals. So you have people who lost all their money, and then what Holland Casino did in those early days is after they had lost all their money and said, I can't get home, I need money for a taxi. Mm. They gave them money for the taxi, which they had to pay back the next time as well. But if you check a signal, if you have lost everything and you can't even go home anymore because you can't pay for a taxi, that's a very simple signal, but very effective in a way of how does it work? There was a registration system with Holland Casino already from the early days. So, in fact, we could see how often people would go to the casino. How often, and we could also check how many people would go to the casino two times per week or more. Is that a signal? It can be a signal, not necessarily it has to be, but we were just, especially in those early days, trying to find out what things look like, so to say. And there was then this combination. I mean, we did mainly the training part, and besides Holland Casino, we started to do in 89 as well, to do training programs for all those guys working in the slot machine arcades, which were of a different type, much lower budget. But I mean, that's what we started to do as well. And there were not a lot of countries where they did all those things, to be honest. And not to say that maybe if you look at Sweden, where Thomas asked me to work with him in Sweden as well, which I did at a certain stage. They were a good next one, but most of the operators that we would meet abroad, and I traveled a lot, to be honest. Most of the operators that we were meeting abroad would say, "Peter, what you say that we are doing, that we should do, that's what we are doing for a very long time already." But honestly, in most cases, it was bullshit. I mean, I do remember the conversation that we had with the CEO at the Dragonera Casino in Malta, as you probably know. The Dragonera in those days was owned by Accor Casinos, which is a French company. And they tried to explain to me as well when I visited them in the 90s, saying, "Peter, what you say is we do it," but it was bullshit because they didn't do a lot. And in fact, that was for me, but then it's a big step further on. That was the issue why we set up G4 at a certain stage. And G4 stands for Global Gambling Guidance Group. And I do remember that the four of us, so Paul and Thomas and I, We were traveling a lot, and we were sitting on a terrace in Melbourne, Australia, at a certain moment, because we were attending a conference at the National Association for Gambling Studies in Australia, and we thought, this is what we should do. We have to set up a kind of ISO standard on responsible gambling, so that operators, in first instance and later also suppliers, can show us that they do what they say they do. So this is how G4 started and got up. But getting back to the to the early days, so to say, when my boss decided that I should do this project, I said, yeah, but then you need to educate me as well. And I was very much aware that Bill Edington, who was leading the University of Nevada, Reno, had set up a training program for casino managers, CEOs, directors, the, what was it called? Oh, the Executive Development Program. And that was held for the very first time in 91. And then I said to my boss, if you want me to understand the industry, you have to allow me to go to this training session in Lake Tahoe for 10 days. It cost a fortune. But then I can learn what it's all about. And that's how I got to a lot of meetings, conferences, and got involved in more on a political level or more in a knowledge level as well regarding the whole issue of problem gambling and responsible gaming, as we called it in those days.
Yeah, I think, I mean, probably, I don't know how many out of 10 here have heard about Bill Edington, but he was quite a crucial figure in the area of responsible gaming, wasn't he?
He definitely was. I mean, and he was the guru, and I think, I mean, I think you are going to Las Vegas as well.
Yes, May. Yes. Mm-hmm.
So am I. I mean, and I honestly, sometimes I still think, should I do this? I will do it anyway. but honestly, it's different from the old days, and that's what you know as well, because Bill Edington's conference was there. We had our conference on behalf of the European Association for the Study of Gambling, EASG, which is going to take place in September this year, John, as well. But Bill and I, in those early days, oh, and there was another one. There was a kind of Australian conference as well. So what we thought that we should do is we divide the world in three parts, the US, the Australasian one, and the European one, and we organize a conference once every 3 years. At the end of the day, that never turned out. I mean, we agreed on that, Bill Edington and I, but the Australians never wanted to skip their annual conference, which they were organizing every year somewhere in Australia. So that never happened. And in fact, Bo Bernard, who took over from Bill Edington, was still claiming, when I discussed this with him, when I said, we are going to move to a 2-year cycle because there's a lot of information and things are changing so rapidly nowadays. And he said, no, we just stick to the 3-year one and we are not going to change it because that's what Bill wanted. Honestly, if you look at, and not only because of Corona, but if you look at it, if the schedule of the 3 years, if that has been there forever, that's not true, because it has been changing a lot in between. But now they are the once every 3 year conference, which is taking place. And I think it's a pity we have to go to Las Vegas again. I mean, I've been there so many times. It's not, there are other places that I would prefer better, but okay, it's the way it is.
I feel your pain, but you'll be delighted to hear that I'll be in Vegas for that as well.
Oh, yeah.
So, well, I think, I mean, these two conferences, everybody should, I mean, who is working, you know, in this area, in the industry, should attend. And, you know, I'm always surprised because, for me, the number of attendees given how many operators there are now, especially with all the regulated markets, is too low, you know, for me. So I think, you know, this could be for sure in the 500, 600, 800 if operators took it more seriously.
Well, yeah, I mean, and that's what I would definitely say. I mean, I checked the program and I thought, oh, there are not too many people from Europe who are going to Las Vegas and are going to present. That's one thing. The other thing, and that's the difference with the European one, is that the Las Vegas one is more focusing on the academic level, so to say, and saying we are the largest academic focused conference, and I think they had, what did they say, 500 presentations?
500, really? That can't be. I mean, that would be crazy.
Yeah, honestly, really. Well, maybe, yeah, that would be really crazy.
In honestly, 2 days?
Honestly, I mean, that wouldn't surprise me if they could better say, no, we have
the Vegas program is extraordinary. I mean, like, seriously, Michael, we're not even going to be in the same room for watching most of these things, because the amount of stuff that's cross-programmed is just unreal.
Yeah. I mean, they always run like 3, 4, 5 parallel sessions, don't they?
More.
Do you think?
No, go ahead.
I was just wondering, like something you guys were just saying a minute ago, do you think it's a reasonable barometer of how seriously the industry takes problem gambling? Do you think the attendance or lack of attendance of people at major conferences, and when I say attendance, I mean not just because they're going to be in Barcelona anyway for ICE, let's go to this RG seminar,
but that's
specialist
that's
events
different.
No, I think it is, because if you take into account, you know, all of the regulators who are there, other, you know, members of whatever, you know, policy boards, researchers, and you just count the number of industry people, right?
Yeah.
Then that's quite low, isn't it? I mean, if you look at, I mean, how many operators are really typically attending? And if you look at it, it's always the same ones, right? I mean, I've been to your conference since 2008. And I mean, literally, you see some guys there, like, you know, from certain casinos or lotteries, you know, and others, I mean, not at all.
Nay, but honestly, that is true. So, but in fact, if you compare the European one with the Las Vegas one, we have by far more regulators and industry than they have.
So yeah. No, because I think the difference is that in Europe, it's much more variety, right? So you have lots of operators, you have different regulation. In the US, it's more or less monopolized, isn't it? I mean,
but it has to do with an investment as well, Michael. So what I invest time and energy in my relationship with the European Casino Association.
Yes, sure. Mm-hmm.
Because I want them to organize a meeting when we have the conference. I do the same with GREF. I mean, this time we do Copenhagen. The chairman of GREF is Anders Dorf, who is the regulator in Denmark.
Let's quickly mention what GREF is, because not everybody might know.
GREF is Gaming Regulators European Forum.
Yes.
So that's not it's a formal organization, but it's not formal decision making, though on the other hand, what they do say nowadays is that they would like to work more and more together and more closely together as well. Mm-hmm. And I just recently saw a new initiative carried out on behalf of the Dutch regulators that we would like to work more together with, I think they have 6 or 7 or 8 of the regulators, where they are going to exchange more information.
Yeah.
We also give the floor to the GREF Responsible Gambling Working Group, so to say. Mm-hmm. I'm talking to the European lotteries as well. Not that they, I mean, because the question is, are these events so different from each other, or are they a bit more lookalikes?
Because the European lotteries, in collaboration with the World Lottery Association, have their RG seminar pretty much around the same time, don't they?
That's what they did 2 years ago. And honestly, because the first thing was because Arjen van Veer was still the Secretary General in those days, saying, "Oh no, maybe we can do it together." No, the European lotteries want to do their own thing. Oh, and then I always think maybe I should be happy that they didn't do this event in the same venue as we were having the conference. Honestly, that's what they did in 2005. We had a conference in Malmö on behalf of the EASG, and then I think the guy was called Göran Westberg, who was working for Svenska Spel, the Swedish operator, so to say. They said, "Peter, by the way, we are going to have a meeting in the same hotel as you are having your conference. The only thing is that we only have one day in common." And then I got so angry that, we kicked him out. So he was not allowed.
I've got a question, but this goes right back in the conversation.
Okay.
And I'm not sure there's an answer to it. So I'll apologize now. Sorry.
Okay.
Something you said very, very early when you started working in the Dutch treatment place.
Yeah.
You mentioned how there was never enough money for funding. Yeah. Never enough money to do everything that everybody wants to do. Now, certainly, so I'm based in Britain, and one of the criticisms of the industry, there's this weird, the people in the argument seem to be suffering a little bit of bipolarity. You hear people saying the gambling industry should not be involved in the funding of treatment at all. And then you have the same people a week later saying, "Well, they caused the problem; they should be paying for it." But the idea that gambling operators be involved in the funding of treatment, in the funding of research and treatment, even when that funding is distributed in a way that the operator can have no influence whatsoever on where that money is allocated, it's still used as a criticism of the industry. And I get it. It's an emotional response. It's not a logical way of looking at things, but I do get it. Here's the thing, right? The reason why what you said struck a chord in me. A lot of the people in 1988 were having issues with alcohol.
Yeah.
Now, as you both know, in most instances, gambling is a symptom of another ill, or is a comorbidity with another ill of some kind. Now, bearing that in mind, say the gambling industry were allowed to fund with zero influence research and treatment, right? Which I don't think would be unreasonable. So often what's required is a cross-agency approach. Because otherwise, as my granddad liked to say, you're pissing in the wind. Because you can treat the gambling addiction all you want, but if you don't treat the alcoholism or the domestic abuse or the heroin dependency or whatever, without treating that, it just comes back around. So with that in mind, when it comes to funding, when it comes to funding treatment, when it comes to funding research, I feel like an awful lot is thrown at the industry's feet. This is your fault. By people who are perhaps not cognizant of the fact that there's something else going on in there as well. Funding for those other treatments is usually government funded.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think, and stop me if I'm wrong, I speak as somebody with an abusive relationship with alcohol, but I'm pretty sure that the alcohol industry isn't funding much at all.
No, I mean, that's the same thing for. Okay, let's do the alcohol industry first. And the question is whether there should be direct funding or indirect funding. And if we talk about direct funding, then we really have the issue at this very moment as well. If you look at gambling researchers who tell us that they never ever want to work together with the industry because they are the enemy. We know those people, and Michael knows those mm-hmm. people as well, who are, I call them the fundamentalists.
Yes.
What I mean with that is that they have their own opinion. They want to do it their way. They want to do it. And they don't want to have any relationship with the industry. I am 100% convinced. What I tried to explain in the late 80s already, and I'm still convinced of that, is that we all play our own role in the whole spectrum, so to say, and that is important. And we have to work together on this. And whether it's the industry, whether it's the regulator, whether it's the operator, the supplier, or the player, him or herself. I mean, I used to say, my very last slide at a certain moment in my presentation usually was, but at the end of the day, it's the individual player who is responsible for his or her own behavior. But I'm not allowed to say that anymore. My regulator, and not only my regulator in the Netherlands, but a lot of others as well, make the operator co-responsible, so there's a shared responsibility regarding the customer.
That's fucking annoying. And I always say regulation and personal responsibility overlap. One never replaces the other.
Yeah, I mean, this is a general, you know, societal shift in terms of gambling harm, because if you look at, you know, the research and the approach over the last couple of years, it's shifted from actually problem gambling to gambling harm. And what that means is you do not necessarily have to be a problem gambler, but if you cause, let's say, psychological distress to your family or whatever, then, you know, you are creating harm. And I can only recommend, like, there is a German, there's a book, at least it's in German. I don't know if it's available in English, but it's called, translated, The Vulnerable Society. So this author, this German lawyer, this extremely interesting book, you know, which absolutely fits into our conversation here. And she makes the point that there are so many society groups in society.
What's her name?
It's called The Vulnerable Gesellschaft in German. Okay, I Google it quickly. Give me a second. Die Vulnerable Gesellschaft. And she was at the conference last year in Germany. And okay. She's called Frauke Rostalski. Frauke is her.
If you send me her details, I could.
It's extremely cool.
To Copenhagen.
Yeah, because what she says is, she says there are so many groups in society which request protection, right?
Yeah.
You know, like minorities.
Yeah.
Whatever, you know, with whatever, you know, aspects. Okay, and of course, what it means is restrictions for others, right? Because if the state has to introduce laws to protect lots of different groups, it means there will also be lots of different restrictions, right?
Yeah.
And that sort of leads at the end of the day to a more authoritarian system, because you need to introduce lots of laws, right? Which is the opposite of complete freedom, right? So if you look at the total libertarian environment where the state basically doesn't, you know, provide any rules, okay, you know, whatever, you shoot your neighbor, okay, you know, his brother will ultimately shoot you, whatever. So, I mean, you can go from the very extreme there, libertarian, to basically, you know, the other day, very authoritative, okay, you have guidelines for everything, you can't do this, you can't do that. And a little bit of the shift we see here in the gambling, where nowadays lots of responsibility is then put on the operators and very little actually on the individual in terms of their own informed decision making. I mean, in Europe mostly, not in the US, right? If you look at the gambling regulation in the US, comparably, it's comparably loose, you know? If you look at the Netherlands, okay, I mean, pretty much many countries, like be it the Netherlands, Germany, also the UK, Spain, they have, I mean, sort of introduced or
around. I mean, the UK used to be the most liberal country related to.
Yeah, but now it's like, okay,
now it's very strict.
You lose £150. And then an affordability background check kicks in.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
In the Netherlands now, there are maximum deposit limits, right, for adults and young adults. You cannot exceed that if you want to exceed.
And I think if you are younger than between 18 and 23 years old, you're not allowed to lose more than, was it, €25 a day or so, something?
You're up to 50 a month, whatever, something like this.
Very so, little money.
Very little, yeah. So we see this shift, and it's interesting, you know, also from what
but,
I
but
do.
But the question is, Michael, I mean, and that's what we know, because you could say a lot of things, but if you look at those who are using treatment facilities for those who are diagnosed as, say, someone who might have developed a problem with their gambling, it's not much more than 10% of all those who have a problem that use those treatment possibilities. And in fact, that's still a little bit more than people with alcohol problems and less than people with drug problems.
Yes, sure.
They have other things. But And that's where it stops for me to a certain extent, because if you look at it, then you have to say, okay, what kind of treatment measures are not only necessary but are useful, so to say. And then if I look at the situation here in the Netherlands and in a couple of other countries, it's more that the treatment facilities that do their work at this very moment only say, we need some more money because then we can help more people, so to say, with their gambling problems. And I think, I mean, why do we have 10%? Because we are offering not the let's say, the right treatments, so to say, or the right possibilities for treatment to the individual, because we want to offer more of the same. While I would say, let's offer a bit less of a bigger diversity, if you understand what I mean. So different methods of treatment, because at the end of the day, to my understanding and my feeling, it's all these treatment solutions are very individualized as well.
So we had this call, this session, John, with John Eli, I think was his name, right?
Eli,
yeah. And we discussed the American, you know, US situation, and especially the sports betting. And I think you called it, John, back then, the college betting, sports, etc.
Okay.
And that obviously, with the introduction of, you know, sports betting and online sports betting, there has been, you know, an uptick in also gambling-related issues.
Yeah.
And my question is, do you think, Peter, or have you come across different, you know, differences across countries with respect to gambling and or sports betting?
I think, if you look at it from a Netherlands point of view, I don't see much difference. Maybe you know it even better than I do, what they do in France, where they don't have And there's a difference between land-based and online. And going back to France, where they have no casino online betting, yeah. but the sports betting, so to say. So it depends a bit on regulations as well. What I think, and that's how it started, because when we are now using the age limitations of 18 up to 23 or 24, 25, whatsoever. This all started about 20 years ago when we were thinking, the four of us, as you remember that I spoke about, the four of us, we were thinking, okay, what is the largest target group that we should pay special attention to? Because when I was at Jelinek in those early days, we had I think it was a psychologist who tried to explain to us in a training program, saying, your brain is still developing when you're 19, 20, 21 years old. So if we want to influence the younger player, the young adults, or the younger alcohol users, so to say, then we should pay special attention to this group of the young ones. And I think it is more a matter of age and the changes than the kind of play that people are doing. I always think, why do we still have slot machines? I mean, if there's one boring thing, then it is a slot machine. Because you put some money in, you have no idea what's happening, you don't have any influence whatsoever.
Yeah, but then, you know, I have the same thoughts, right? And yeah. I'm thinking, okay, for me personally, this is completely uninteresting, right? Yeah. So I'd never, you know, play the online casino or casino. I only do it when I whatever go to Vegas, you know, because somehow, you know, it's for me more exciting because of the environment. But then again, you know, it's actually a very extremely exotic activity, right? If you think of it, how many people in adult society play the online casino? That's very few. Like the prevalence rate is very few. If you, you know, of course, don't count lottery, you know, draw or scratch cards or something like this. But obviously, there is a certain group of people out there, and they like it. And among those, there is an even smaller group, and they like it a lot, you know. And if you look at all of the online gambling operators' distribution of revenue across the active player base, you see that it's very top heavy. And I think it can't be any different, because that's simply how this product works. You know, you have a few and they just like it. And, you know, they like it so much. And if you don't sort of, you know, monitor them, they will completely go overboard, because, you know, the focus should be there. And I think we always have to keep in mind, these people are different, you know, and they are, maybe some of us, you know, are also gamblers, of course, but it's hard, you know, to put yourself into their minds, because it's just such an exotic activity. But these people, you know, they are out there, wherever, you know, it is. Or like you mentioned, in France, you don't have online casino legalized. Of course, people play the online casino. I mean, I mean, it doesn't make any sense, right, to not to have it, because they're gonna do it, you know, wherever they can.
Well, and honestly, and then you get to the whole discussion that we are having nowadays. And if you look at the legal versus the illegal market, where everyone is saying, I think they said in the Netherlands now it's 50-50 or something.
Yeah, like, and I think it's even not, you know, I would even go so far as industry doesn't really, I mean, it's not interested in regulation, because you make much more money in an unregulated market, because if you have to comply with the Netherlands, then with Germany, then with Spain, I mean, the overhead of the administrative overhead of all of this and all those specific rules they introduce, which of course doesn't make any sense to have a different rule in the Netherlands than different to the UK, different to Spain. I mean, it's ultimately, you know, all humans playing there. You have, you know, as an operator, you have to comply with all of that. And that doesn't really help the individual, because ultimately the regulation should help the player, right? prevent somebody from developing a problem. And for me, it doesn't make any sense that this looks different here and there, but that's just how the world is, you know? I mean, here in Austria, we have 9 Bundesländer, like 9, you know, regions. And for sports betting, I mean, they have different rules, even for slot machines. I mean, doesn't make any sense, you know? If I drive 5 minutes, I'm in the next Bundesland, and there's a different rules for slot machines. I mean, come on. I mean, it's like... But that's just, you know, my opinion.
Could I... You know, I had that bit of a ramble about cross-agency stuff. I know that I'm about to ask a stupid question, okay?
It's okay.
Rest assured, I already know that. Here's what I was wondering, right? So that cross, when I was rambling about that, I was saying gambling industry could fund gambling industry research and treatment, right? But all of those other comorbidities generally come under government funding, and they're generally all wildly underfunded as well. I know it's a stupid question, but this also gets to the heart of why we started this podcast, right?
Okay.
There are enormous commonalities across addictions in how addiction is recognized as addiction. I mean, addiction is a clinical classification, right? So addiction is a thing with a set of characteristics, which is how it's recognized to be an addiction. Are there treatment commonalities where if somebody comes to you in 1988, Peter, or hell, you now, where those comorbidities with all of their overlap are treatable as addiction, not necessarily as their specificities. Does that make sense?
It's a difficult question. I mean, I'm not a psychologist, not a psychiatrist. So what I do is look at...
Oh, the question was to both of you.
Yeah.
Come again. I didn't pay attention.
So what I do remember from those early, to get back to those early days, when I met the guys of Gamblers Anonymous, the AGOG, which is not only Gamblers Anonymous, but also for the relatives of those who have developed a problem. And I've been at a number of these sessions as well, of Gamblers Anonymous, not only in the Netherlands, by the way, but I do remember that I was standing hand in hand in Hong Kong with the Gamblers Anonymous people there. But I've seen people that stop their gambling behavior but now have a full belly because they are drinking alcohol and the other way around. So it looks a bit like that you have to treat all these different forms of addiction related to the individual, and maybe even if we make it bigger and look at it from a mental health point of view. I listened to on my way to the office this morning, I listened to the radio, and they were saying that we have waiting lists, and that's probably the same in the UK as well, for everything, so that all people who have developed a mental health issue or have developed a mental health problem are on a waiting list before they can start their treatment possibility, so to say. I find it very difficult to say, okay, this works and this doesn't work, because it is so different from all the individual people that it's very hard for me to say, okay, this is the way we should do it.
Okay.
And Michael?
But, yeah, fundamentally, Michael, what I was asking is addiction as a thing treatable, as opposed to treating the specificity of addictions where there are more than one more than one addiction, you know, so I mean, gambling is a comorbidity.
What you are asking is actually, is there something like an addictive personality, right? Like a person who would sort of, I mean, we had this conversation with Andrew Kim, remember? He actually didn't really agree, you know, with the addictive personality, and I think others don't either. But I mean, I think it's certainly the more extreme case, but it looks like it, right? I mean, we also discussed before, like the you know, the religious aspect that often, I mean, and you see this among, like, you know, singers, actors, celebrities, that often when they manage to control a substance addiction, they would, you know, become extremely religious.
That's the other possibility. That's what we saw a lot with our methadone program, guys, in the early 80s, so to say. I've been a very heavy smoker. I could smoke 2 packets of cigarettes, more than 40 cigarettes a day, until someone told me it was not very healthy. And then I thought, oh, well, then I better stop. Now, I mean, honestly, at a certain moment, I thought, why did I stop? Because I thought, Jesus Christ, I'm in my 40s. how can I breathe? I have problems doing this. And the most important one was, we have 7 grandchildren, and I didn't want to die young. So there's one thing you could help is give up your smoking, so to say.
Yeah.
It was rather easy. But my wife, I think, was it a year ago? I mean, I haven't smoked for 25 years. My wife never wanted to stop at the very same time. She had maybe 10 or 15 attempts whatsoever. Mm, yes. And every now and then she still smokes a cigarette. Then she's standing in the garden, and I'm upstairs in my office room, so to say, what are you doing?
But yeah, but what you are talking about is really stages of change, right?
That's what it is.
Exactly. People don't
know. How important is it for you to change your behavior?
Exactly. You have to weigh the benefits of the change against the benefits of, you know, the activity in smoking. Okay, you enjoy the smoke. I don't know. The dizziness.
Not that simple for everybody, though, is it?
Nah, I know it's not simple, but what I'm trying to say is it's rare, or it's more likely that somebody goes through a process, and that's also what, you know, in psychological treatment.
And honestly, that's what we learn, the guys at Holland Casino or at the operators level, is say, okay, how to deal with it. And it has to do with changing behavior. I mean, I was brought up on motivational interviewing by Bill Miller and Stephen Rolnick themselves in 96 or 97 or so. So I was a accredited trainer for a very long time, until I stopped paying my membership fee, and then they took me off the list. But I don't care. I mean, but that's what it is. It has to do with your motivation of changing your behavior.
Well, that ties in with what I was asking about treating addiction as a thing. But I'll come to that in a second. Are you too familiar with the work of Eddie Vedder?
Eddie Vedder?
Pearl Jam, you mean?
The singer from Pearl Jam.
Even flow. Yeah.
That's terrible. Never do that again, Dr. Hauer. Stick to doctoring. I heard a great story last week. I was listening to a podcast, and he was a guest on a podcast.
Okay.
And he had quit smoking, and then he started again during COVID. And he's like, shit, what am I doing? I'm a singer, you know, my lungs are really important. I'm a surfer, you know what I mean? Like, being fit, it's important to me. And he said he was on a call with Martin Short. Are you familiar with Martin Short?
Yes, the actor. Canadian.
The actor and comedian Martin Short. And apparently he said to Martin Short, Martin Short's like, oh, Eddie, how are you? And Eddie's like, I'm okay, but I'm a bit disappointed with myself. I started smoking again. And apparently Martin Short just said to him, oh, are you waiting for new literature on that? And Eddie said, and I haven't smoked since.
Yeah.
Because it's highlighting the absurdity of what he's done
in a way
that really hits home. But what I was thinking about there, right? One of the things, certainly, I'm speaking for myself, right? Speaking as somebody that I can get addicted to almost anything, weirdly, except gambling. But a lot of my destructive behaviors have involved sort of self-medication.
Okay.
So there is a root cause back there, you know?
Yeah.
And that ties in with what you guys were just saying a minute ago about the mental health aspect of all of this. And let's face it, I'm not sure there is a government on earth, maybe Norway, I don't know. I'm not sure there is a government on earth that is properly funding mental health research and care. Like in the UK, the Tories back in the 90s stripped everything down to the bare bones. And we ended up with something called care in the community. So I'm supposed to just look after my fucking next door neighbor. Like, don't get me wrong, I like the neighbors on that side. But the neighbors on that side, if they have mental health problems, they're on their fucking own. But you know what I'm saying? What I'm saying is, like, for an awful lot of addiction problems and gambling addiction, but for an awful lot of addiction problems, the root cause of the initial behavior can be as simple as, I've got bad shit going on, or I've had bad shit going on.
Of course.
And I don't want to sit here thinking about it.
Of course. I mean, that's absolutely.
But that's the thing that's never funded properly. Never. Do you know what I mean? Like, in certainly in the UK, therapy's treated as like, oh, having a bit of therapy, are you? But I'm a big fan of therapy. And I'll say to people happily, yeah, I fucking love therapy. You should get some because you're a dick. But people aren't, like in the US, certainly when you see it in movies and TV and that, people have therapy and they're loving it. So if you haven't got a therapist, you're a loser. Like, that's the attitude we should be going at this with. That we should be saying to kids, you know, yo, you don't know what you want to do? Be a fucking therapist because everybody should have one. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
I'm describing a wild utopia.
Are you looking at me here, John? I can't really tell.
I'm looking at both of you.
Both ones.
I was just rambling out there, sorry.
Oh, good conversation.
No, I didn't come to any conclusions. Oh, no, Dr. Arrows is gesturing to his watch that he's not wearing. Are you wearing a watch, Peter?
Peter is big into watches, right?
I have. Well, honestly, I'm not wearing a watch today, but I have quite a number of watches that I collect, and not the ones that are very costly, like €5,000 or €5,000, but different from the others. So if they are fun, then I just buy them.
Okay, because...
And the main thing is that on Saturday morning, there's a marketplace not far from where we are. Yeah, I know.
Snoopy.
Not far from where I live. And if I bring my watches on Saturday morning, I have to pay a fortune to change the batteries.
That's why I bought this one. It's an automatic mechanism. Very
good. Oh, yeah. I have one like that as well. It belonged to my grandfather. But when he was old, he was always sitting still at the table. So I said, the only thing you have to do is move your arm a little bit every now and then. But he never did, so he gave it to me.
Wow, that's a nice way to find a nice watch. I've got one final question for you, Peter. And you probably get asked this a lot, right? It's kind of in two parts. So you've been married for 51 years, 52 years this October, right? 51 years. And happy marriage?
Well, the good thing about being married, and if you do it in the right way, is that you do your own things as well. So I'm not the one who's always at home and doing everything with the two of us, so to say. We have our own thing that we would like to do.
Smoking cigarettes in the garden, by the sounds of it.
Well, that's what she did. No, I mean, I don't think she does it. Well, maybe. I think she... Anyway, doesn't matter.
When you're at your conferences, she's out there with a crack pipe.
Oh, then she said, oh. Well, honestly, she never joins me when I go to a conference. She did it once in 2000 when we had a conference in Warsaw, in Poland.
She learned that lesson.
And that was around her birthday. So I had a Dutch friend who was who lives in Vienna, by the way, and I said, Flip, maybe you can take care of Jocelyn, my wife, because it's her birthday and I'm busy with the conference. So then she said, this is the first and this is the last time I've ever joined you at the conference. She never joined me afterwards. The only thing is that what we did every now and then is when I went to a conference in San Francisco, I said, if you come a couple of days later, then we rent a car and we have a drive for a week or so, and then we are having fun. No, don't do this at the conference. I mean, no.
Is this the secret for you? That's the secret for you is to have those...
Have the possibility to... Usually, and maybe that's also because I worked quite a bit, usually the question in our house on Sunday morning is not, what are we going to do today? No, what are your plans for today? And then I just stay at home and do the garden, which I hate.
Me too. And I gotta cut the grass now.
I worked for 2 hours yesterday afternoon because it was very nice weather.
The garden can do one. Peter, thank you so much for joining us. Michael, did this fulfill your expectations?
No.
Absolutely. Over the top.
Peter's just put us both in our places very firmly there.
We do another session with Peter in Vegas. We ask him all of the intimate questions.
Very good.
You can.
I can point out all of Peter's girlfriends there, you know. Former girlfriends.
You're just saying that because now you know his wife's not going to listen to this. You're terrible people. Peter, thank you so much for joining us.
I was about, oh no, just wait.
Thank you.
You're welcome, sir.